Okay, so I will deal with the same things as Nuku, but I will concentrate on real-time evolution and real-time correlation functions. There will be some repetition as well, but not too much. So first, to motivate, we all know that these pictures are very hard to understand. That's partly what this program is all about. We cannot use perturbation theory because it's not a weakly coupled system. Even though the coupling might be small, the occupation numbers are high, and that makes all loop order equally important. So we cannot use that if the occupation number is order 1 over alpha. We can do lattice calculations, but most of the lattice calculations are in equilibrium with some exceptions like the maximum entropy method for the spectral function, but it's not sufficient for this kind of problem. So there are high occupation numbers, we can think of classical description that can work for some times, but it cannot describe the approach to thermal equilibrium even, and not the hadronization, that's clear. Process. So we need something first principle which we could use. So here classical doesn't work. We could use the direct method, which would be a Schrödinger equation for a wave function of the system, but the Hilbert space is very big. You need to have a wave function which the domain of which are the field configurations. Even for tiny lattices, this makes for a huge Hilbert space, and it's practically impossible to do this. We can turn to the path integral formalism, and there we see that we have to be able to calculate averages with e to the is. Written here, but this means that the usual Monte Carlo methods won't work. We have here positive and negative measures. That means we cannot do Monte Carlo. One method which we could use, as we heard from Nuku, is the stochastic quantization. Originally by Parisi and Wu, it was invented for Euclidean field theories, where you are interested in such averages with some operator e to the minus s is the measure, and you normalize it. And as we learned, we now introduce a new time, a Langevin time. Unfortunately, I call it tau, Nuku called it theta. But this is the Langevin time. We write up a process in this time, with a drift term which comes from the action and some noise, some Gaussian noise with zero mean and in a certain second.
Earlier you thought the width of the Gaussian was tau dependent, I think it was tau, yeah?
Because that was discretized, but in continuum there it's just like this. When you discretize it, you get here a square root of delta tau. Square root, because it's like a random wall process, you know, that goes with the squared average is proportional to the time. So this noise is essentially a random wall. And when you are interested in these averages, you take your quantity as it evolves in Langevin time and you average. And it can be proven using the Fokker-Planck equation, which is the equation of motion for the probability distribution, I call it P, of the field in the action, the X. You can write this equation, and when you analyze this, you can see that this Fokker-Planck-Hamiltonian if you have a real action has positive eigenvalues, which means that it will converge, and it's very easy to see that the where it converges is the e to the minus s, exactly what you need. So for real action, this is a working method, a bit more expensive numerically as a Monte Carlo. So if you can do Monte Carlo, then this is not the best. But if you have complex action, which is what you need when you want to do real-time evolution, you cannot use Monte Carlo. So you are interested in such averages. If you use the Schwinger-Kelbisch contour, then you can write it up with a path integral where this contour is the Schwinger-Kelbisch, and then you can just blindly go ahead and try to solve this with the Langevin equation. And this means that you have an I here, so the price which you have to pay for this is really high. The field complexifies. Even if it was started from a real value, it will be complex. There have been much literature in this, and recently it was applied to equilibrium, after which I also started working with them, and we made another two publications. So the main thing here is that you have a 5D classical system which is governed by the Langevin equation, and when you do the averages in the end, you have the 4D quantum averages. You can ask, is it still the same theory? It's just gets complexified, and the answer is yeah, the averages will be real or will be in the group which you want to be, and we know this because the Schwinger-Dyson equations are fulfilled. I will speak about this in more detail later, the Schwinger-Dyson. So you see, real scalar gets to be a complex scalar. If you do field theory, then SU2 link variables will be SL2C, which means special linear. So the determinant of the matrix is still 1, but it's not true that the adjungate is the inverse.
So what are the problems with doing Langevin-Gauge
theory? Mm-hmm.
Gauge degrees of freedom
don't
converge,
they can fall
short.
Yeah, this is exactly this.
If they come back, that's no problem. Non-conductive.
Yeah, this is what the talk is about.
But his point is exactly.
Exactly, this is my point. Yeah.
And he was talking about how to control that and whether you can control it. It's exactly the point of problems. And there are some suggestions how to cope with it.
I don't get all the theoretical problems. So the system forever is used in a gauge direction. And we calculate some gauge not to the operator to go, but in the right hand now, maybe it will never converge. But why is it a problem?
You cannot feel the group because it's non-compact. So
if you have time,
it's like doing gauge, it's like doing the final graphs without picking the gauge. So it's
and see, it could take very long to wander off the, say, SU2 one point. It could wander off forever, then come back, and what you get is your long time, longer time limit, really, may not be the correct value.
But the gauge in there is supposed not to depend on the gauge.
Once it converges.
Yeah.
But it may take so long that your computer time is not sufficient. But there are some ways.
So maybe even if it is not converging, it goes forever in this direction. You still get gauge invariant quantities in front of the
problem. Yeah, so as Nuku mentioned, there is no general proof of convergence. And indeed, there are cases known where it works and gives good results, but there are also cases when it doesn't work, doesn't converge, or it can even give be convergent and give incorrect results.
So what are the cases where the non-cases?
Well, some of the models which I will show have certain regions with correct and incorrect results. I will show that later.
Non-linear gauge theories with a beta that is not close to the continuum, so strong coupling fluctuations, those fluctuations that you were talking about off the original gauge group can destroy. So small coupling is something where it works.
We all already heard about this runaway in trajectories. The way I see it, it's not a problem, because in continuum, if you do the continuum Langevin time, then the probability of a runaway trajectory is zero. If you do a discretization, then if you get far enough before it would turn back, then you will have numerical problems. So it's only a numerical problem. And if you use smaller and smaller Langevin time steps, then the probability of getting far enough for breakdown will be smaller and smaller. So this problem can be dealt with. And so that's the basics. Let's see what happens if we apply to scalar field theories. We have a complex time contour. I will show on the next slide what kind of time contours we use, which start from zero in time and go to minus I times beta. We discretize the action in a most simple fashion. From this we can get the Langevin equation, which we discretize, and here is the square root of the time, Langevin time step appears. And basically that's it. We did it for an interacting field theory. Or, well, in this plot that I will show, it was just one oscillator, so a zero-dimensional theory, if you will. First, we tried thermal equilibrium, which means that we have periodic boundary conditions. The field in the starting point and the ending point is the same. So what we see, the contours first. So this would be the Schwinger-Keldysh. We know that it makes no difference that if you just don't make this and then come back, but make a straight line and get to minus e beta. And we can also try these triangles. And this is good because we saw that if we have a downward slope in the contour, it acts as a regulator, a bit like plus I epsilon in the mass. Not the same way, but the result is the same. So it helps. And you can see here, if you do the free theory and do the eigenvalue problem, then you will see that these contours which have a slope have the fewest of small eigenvalues, which would mean slow convergence. So now a result. A real-time two-point function. So this is real-time, and this is two-point function with zero, field at zero, and field at t. And we use such a contour, an almost horizontal upper part, so it's almost the real-time result, and the part here which will give some temperature. And so this size gives us the temperature. And so the dots are the simulations, and the continuous line is a Schrödinger equation solution. So we see that it works really nice. It's not a perfect method, so if you increase the length of the contour, it gets worse and worse.
So if you go to longer physical times.
So if you increase this length of the contour, then it gets worse and worse.
But you can correct by going to larger lattices equation.
No. Well, this is not a lattice, it's just one oscillator. The first thing.
The error is dominantly just due to your sampling error in integrating the stochastic equation, or is it discretization error?
I think it's a discretization error.
It sounds now as if there is a continuous getting worse. That's not true.
Yeah, that's what I want to
extend the real time, so going away from the Euclidean time axis, you can extend it, and nothing happens, and suddenly,
at some point,
things break down. So it's not that it goes continuously worse and worse, but there is a region of convergence, and it comes to that point.
So what happens at that point?
At that point, suddenly, those fluctuations you were talking about grow large.
And in this model, what's that time?
You can say that this is like a half oscillation or a quarter, if you will, and it breaks down at like half, so double of this time or so.
So you can't see multiple oscillations.
Unfortunately, not. Yes. Yeah, I have another plot with some other parameters where you see a more interesting behavior. So it's not like a freeze theory. It's essentially the same thing, only with a bigger beta, and that allows us to go a bit farther. So it also depends on how the temperature, and in this case we could achieve this curve.
So you could say, if the real-time extent of the contour is small on the size of the imaginary time extent. Yeah. So if you really have a large imaginary time extent, so small temperature, you can go to large real-time.
Curious, because if you have a very high temperature, classical statistics get better and better approximation.
Yeah, exactly.
It just goes in opposite corner. It has to do with continuity. Yeah. So if you have a large imaginary time extent, a small deviation in the complex plane is close to the Euclidean result. And if you have a short time extent, high temperature, it's 1 over T, then it's a large deviation. So it's all about continuity.
Okay, now we come to the long-awaited question of the non-equilibrium behavior. In field theory, you have a density matrix which appears here, and then the rest is the same, the path integral which you have. So you have two more variables at the beginning of the contour, and then the end of the contour, and the density matrix, and the path integral for the rest of the fields on the contour. So now we exponentialize the density matrix, include these first two fields in the integral, and then we have a path integral which look just like the one we had before. We change the action because we included the rho here in that, and then we can just apply the same Langevin method. So the action was upper field, lower field, and this part comes from the density matrix. But you can include any density matrix, you just have to derive them, and then you get a drift for the first and the last fields. What we tried was a Gaussian density matrix. We can have five parameters. We used two of them. So the field was non-zero, and there was some this.
Can I ask
yes?
A stupid question at the point before? Why can't you just apply your method like multiple times with small real physical time steps? So you calculate a small step in real time and take the value until you trust your method as an initial input for the next.
Yeah, what this method does is calculates you a path integral. So you could do a short time, and then you have to get the information out what state does it arrive to. And it's a pretty hard thing to, you have infinitely many parameters. So you have to do this, you could do some approximation, but it's hard to get the whole state out of it. You can measure any operator, but you have to measure a lot to get the state out. So what we get here, the results, the Schrödinger equation on the real contour of the normal Schrödinger equation is this dotted line. The black line is a Schrödinger equation on a complex contour, because we had to use 5% slope to make it convergent. And then we have three contours, one which ended here, one ended here, and the last one ends here. And we say that they more or less give the result of the Schrödinger equation. But if we go to farther, then it gets worse. And at some point it breaks down completely. Yeah, so this is about scalars. We did it for pH theory, so now not just an oscillator, but a whole field theory. We use the standard Wilson action with betas. Now we have, because we are Minkowski and we have a minus here instead of the temporal, in front of the temporal placket. The updating, because of we are now in an SU2 group, looks a bit different than it looked for scalars, but this is just some structure which respects the gauge group structure, and instead of the partial derivative we have this so-called left derivative. The link variables are SU2 matrices. You have several choices how to parameterize them. We used, instead of the angles, we use this one with one with four real numbers, and there's this which they have to satisfy, so it's just three parameters. Now if we solve this equation, they complexify, which means they become complex numbers, but they still have to agree with this condition.
Does this respect the Gaussian constraint?
The Gaussian constraint would be an... so you could measure it and it would be zero, but it can be as along the trajectories, only the average would be zero.
But in the asymptotic late stochastic conjugate time, is it going to be satisfied?
If the method works, yes, but it's not built in.
It's not built in.
For an arbitrary point on the longitudinal trajectory, you have arbitrary large violations of Gauss's law.
Yes.
That's not very good, no.
But on the you are interested in average, and if you're on average, it's okay.
You're averaging over, well, basically what it means is that you have you're averaging over configurations that have arbitrary charges sitting somewhere in the lattice, right? Which are not configurations you're interested in.
This is true, but the Schwinger-Dyson equation, which is my next point. No? Okay.
There are cases where you see degenerate large deviations, and there are cases where you see does, well, except for instance, weak coupling, strong coupling. So yes, there are cases where you see does not produce correctly the averages, but in all other cases,
I don't actually understand what you say. Ordinary lattice gauge theory. The integral over what we usually call time-like length variables is enforcing Gauss's law. Mm-hmm. Configuration by configuration, it's not there at all. But it's the job of that integral over time-like lengths to give you the projection you want.
Mm-hmm. And here you have a time-like length.
Yeah, so it's...
time-like lengths are just the same way.
Oh, okay. So then I understand.
It also included these kind of configurations in the path integral. So So now Schwinger Dyson in a bit more detail. If you take this equation, that the block, no, this is just one link. The link average doesn't change. If you do one more time step, if you massage this a little bit, you get this equation out, which is the first Schwinger Dyson equation. If you do the same for Plucket averages, that it doesn't change in one time step, then you get this equation, which doesn't look familiar for the ones who have seen the Schwinger Dyson in continuum. But these are the genuine Schwinger Dyson equations for lattice gauge theory. They can be also derived using the invariance of the hard measure of the integration. So these are the second set of Schwinger Dyson equations. And if you follow this procedure with more and more elaborate loops here, then you will get all the Schwinger Dyson equations in this fashion.
Any observable you're interested in, you have to regard as an analytic function of your complexified variables.
Yes.
And you just get garbage if you choose an anti-analytic.
Yeah, if you choose just the real part of something, that's not, that will be divergent.
Any operator you take the average of it, it will fulfill the correction of that equation.
I just want to clarify when you say that, there's a choice about how you write it in terms of your complexified variables.
Where
that choice was being forced on me.
You just use analytical continuation. So you use the same analytical form.
So you mean the step from SU2 to SL2C? There's no choice.
Well, it's demanding analyticity of your observable.
I don't see where I demand analyticity of your observable. I just say those observables that I can generate from the SL2C dynamics fulfill the same Schwinger-Dyson equations if I look at all observables that I could imagine from SE2.
But there are lots of observables one writes, you know, the permission conjugate of some link variable to represent one backwards.
Oh, there
or you write the inverse.
Oh, there are more things.
They're equivalent.
You mean there are more things you could write down in SL2C than in SE2? It's the real part of some quantity that would be complex in SU2C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's a map, I suppose. You have links like this. You associate with inverses in SU2C.
No, there's just one link. There's no two links on the same line.
The link has an arrow.
But the inverse is an analytic function.
And that's all I'm saying.
It's the inverse.
It's
the inverse.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's good. So you cannot take the adjungate, but you can take the inverse. So what we have proven here, what we have proven is that if we manage to get this system to an equilibrium in Langevin time, then we will get a solution of the Schwinger-Dyson equations, all of them. The problem is that there is not just one solution to these equations. For example, in analytic calculations, one usually has to give the UV behavior or something like that. Let's see what happens if we do a simulation and plot the two sides of the Schwinger-Dyson equation. We see that after some initial time, they nicely agree. Then something happens, and then they agree again. But it's a difference.
And something even more peculiar happened at 2.6?
2.6 is an error bar. Oh. The fluctuations are much bigger. So here you get this kind of fluctuation, here you get this one.
Huge fluctuations.
So these huge
fluctuations. That was huge fluctuations.
So if he says they agree, if he wouldn't have smoothed out this outer region there, there would be tons of points scattered all over the plane. So what you see is, yes, for short Langevin times, the Shringer-Dyson equation is nicely fulfilled. Then error accumulates and blows up the solution. So I wouldn't say that at late times you see a solution of the Shringer-Dyson equation because the error bars are so big.
It's really breaking down at one.
Yes. And so the question is whether you can control this breakdown time. And I guess that's what you would be talking about.
Yes, and
about these large fluctuations. They become large at one.
And let's first find out what these two regions are. So if we have an arbitrary contour, and if we measure a quantity which just depends on one time, then we should get the same result, but we can also get in equilibrium. And one side of the Shringer-Dyson equation is the Plaquette average, which for a Euclidean contour is this curve. So if we now make a contour with a triangle, then we have this kind of curve. It first goes to the Euclidean result, which is the physical result, and then it breaks down and gets to another point. And if you go farther away from the Euclidean, this thing happens earlier. But you see, the physical result is there, but then some process drives it away from, drives the system away from that. And so the question, what do we do now? And what we do is we go to a simpler model and try to find out this, how this works. The simpler model is what Nuku already showed us. It's just a one Plaquette model. This is the action. These are the averages that we are interested in. It's a very simple thing. Let's try it for e to the I phi, and we can do this integral numerically. We get this result. We do the Langevin simulation, and then we get this distribution. This is the complex plane of the phi variable. And we get this kind of distribution, and then you see the average is zero. It fills the complete plane, so it gives a wrong result. So what do we do now? Let's generalize this section. We had this part first. Let's add this term. And we correct this term in the observable. So we do a reweighting. This is the formula. Each of these lines is the same as it would be with 0p. But now we take part of the action and say that this is the new action. We will do the Langevin simulation with this new action. And if we try p equals 1, then we have, according to this formula, the average of 1 over the average of e to the minus I 5. We do it and we get the point 5.75. So this way it works. So let's find about this new action. It must mean that the new action works. The Langevin method with the new action works. With this particular combination, we were here with beta equals 1. We see that this average is the same with numerical integration and simulation. With p equals 1. So we were here. If we would increase the beta, then we would see a region where it doesn't work. If we decrease it, then it gives the correct result. Let's look at the flow chart of the field. This is again the field of the complex plane of the field. And I drew these lines there, which tell us the direction of the drift term. They are normalized, so not the size of the drift term, but just the direction. And let's look at these two regions, this this plot corresponds to this situation here, and this other plot corresponds to here, where it doesn't work. So where it works, we see that there is a fixed point here, an attractive, and there's here a repulsive fixed point, and we see that the five field is the distribution is centered around a fixed point. When it works, when it doesn't work, we don't have an attractive fixed point. We have two circular fixed points here, and we see that these they are indifferent, so they are just circles. So this is a nice small distribution with not too much fluctuations, but we see fields with some probability everywhere. So this is a large distribution with fluctuations and incorrect results. So one way to make this method work is to change the action in such a way that it will inhibit a fixed point, and it will have to be an attractive fixed point which would make the fluctuation smaller. Another way to decrease the fluctuation is to go to the classical limit. Yeah, the same action. If we just increase the overall factor of the action, then we should in the end get the classical fixed point, which is just the zero derivative of the action in this case. So we started here. If we just increase the overall factor, we get closer and closer to the fixed point, and we see the classical averages. This is one thing. Another thing which applies for gauge theories, we have to go to a bit more complicated model, which is a one Plaquette model, but now this one Plaquette is an SU2 variable. And this has a gauge, so-called gauge symmetry, so this is a symmetry of this action. So we can here study what happens if we fix the gauge. So the same thing applies. We can get the exact averages numerically. We have management updating. We use the same parametrization as for field theory. And what we do more is that we fix the gauge. After each management time step, I do such a symmetry transformation. And with this, I fix the A I cannot change because gauge invariant, but the B's I can get to this. So two of them I get to zero. And then what we see? If we don't do the gauge fixing, we get this distribution of the trace in the complex plane. If we do the gauge fixing, we get this. And this gives a wrong result. The numerical integration gives 0.26, we get zero. With gauge fixing, we get exactly what we would like to get. So now let's apply this, what we have learned, to the field theory. So now it's a field theory. We do gauge fixing, we use maximal axial gauge, and we use a smaller gauge bare coupling, which means closer to the continuum limit, continuum fixed point. And here's the difference. This was the old case, which we have seen the Plaquette average was for some time the Euclidean, and then it went away from that. We can see this behavior in a quantity which measures how far the Plaquette have gone from the Euclidean in the non-compact directions, so the imaginary part, and we see that this just grows quite big. If we do the gauge fixing, then the average stays there, and this distance from the Euclidean stays controlled. Notice that here the time scale was 0.5, it's 50. So this solves the problem. However, the G what we have to had to use to achieve this is too small. It should mean
the gate, yeah, the gate, for example, is presenting both together.
Yeah, the gauge fixing, the coupling was the same for these two plots. So between these two plots, only the gauge fixing is there. But
even if you do the bottom one for the larger coupling, it breaks down.
Then breaks down, yes.
We require both.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this G which we require is too small. So we cannot have the lambda QCD on this lattice. Even though it doesn't seem to depend on the lattice size, it would be such a huge lattice that we cannot do it in practice.
It sees both things, the classical limit, both the continuum limit, means going to the classical limit, suppresses fluctuation,
right,
and gauge fixing suppresses
fluctuation. Once you fix the gauge, you
do it. Yeah, it's a complete gauge fix, yes.
And, it's not the gauge fluctuation.
So what you see is if you go one slide back, if you could now ask, what is it that drives you away from the real trace of U? Because the imaginary part of the trace of U, you don't have an SE2 filter. You have a larger group, SL2C, that allows more operators. So in principle, nothing prevents you from wandering out in the complex plane. I'm not sure one can ask, what is the physics that makes these operators large? They're just allowed, so they will appear. And if you go to sufficiently late longitudinal times, they'll just grow. It's amazing that with gauge fixing, you can get such a compact distribution. But, I mean, it's not zero, it's not really, it's just compact. And of course, if you increase the coupling, you can imagine that the distribution grows again.
So,
so I was basically finished.
You're very so decoupled with affirmative.
Yes, so alternatively, you could work, and indeed, one can also study things perturbatively that has also been done in scalar theories, for instance, a long time ago, and things work. But you have to go to the extreme perturbative limit, but that's not where you would like to simulate.
But this is a very weak coupling.
This is a very weak coupling.
So it's because of the fact that you're doing SL2C that perturbation theory is breaking down.
No, so at very weak coupling it works.
But
so
this isn't, 0.5 isn't very weak coupling.
It's very weak coupling.
So come back. It's true, it's not very weak, but if you then ask what is the typical lattice size you would need for 0.5, it's still too big. In some future time when we have bigger lattices, then one could put it maybe on a lattice.
But 10 to the 15?
I
Yeah, but if that's the lattice size, I mean, that's a very weak coupling lattice size.
And you're saying G of 0.5 is close to where this is going to break down?
0.5 you can simulate.
Yeah.
If you go to larger G, say 1, or 1, then breaks down.
It depends on the contour, so the slope of the contour. If you go very close, then it will break down very early. It will, if it slopes, then it breaks down later.
So there are two dots to not clarify. One is using a gauge as a type of calculation, or going through the classical limit by going to very small g as a
calculation. If I did gauge an SL2T gauge, I would have
normal action no longer be bound to go up.
Yes. So is that the source of it? That's the fine. So now that somehow if you were doing
that analytically,
well, that could accept it as somehow the analytic problem more physically. You're supposed to deal with that, right? It had to control it, but of course that's...
No, you see, what you what you're saying would lead to exponentially growing fluctuations.
You know, it's something, it may be eventually, yes, but you know, if you did things, as you say, exactly, because of the inactivity, those most vulnerable things. You're taking well-behaved part of the animal.
But this property is only for the averages.
Right.
The property that it's the Euclidean result is only for the averages. So one configuration can go far in the bad behaving mode.
Just to be clear, you're saying that the business of really having a pretty sharp limit on either the value of the coupling you can get to or the maximum real time you can get to, this is not sensitive to discretization use.
I only tried the
real property of the formulation.
I only tried the Wilson action, so I cannot say.
But your discretization of the logical equation.
That doesn't matter.
It does not look like a pure numerical problem. It looks more complicated.
Because we tried different distributions, and it's true that these runaway potentials, you can deal with it if you just decrease relativity.
Finite density QCD, you go out to the large density region, and suddenly fluctuations overwhelm your signals, essentially, and there's a finite range of applicability to these reweighting techniques, for example.
But there you have more or less continuous transition. But because it's in a sense, it's a signal to noise problem.
Yes.
While here, at some point, it shows it's no longer controllable. So it looks like here there are some more interesting, let me say, problems, and there is a lot of things to be done. There is very few understood about that generally. It's not like the Monte Carlo for it now, practically everything, including problems of sign or overlap, like for density. You know the principle of the problem. But here we still have a lot of things to do.
So
it is interesting.
It could be, for instance, that if you collect statistics arbitrarily long, it comes back to the original, to the correct result. But, I mean, it may not be a discretization error or a numerical problem, but if you have something that drifts away from SU2 into this complex plane, it may take much too long to gather statistics to have something that converges to the physical result. In that respect, it's killing me.
But earlier it looked like this was associated with the change from having an attractive fixed point to having fixed points that are, well, that have circles around them, that are neither attractive nor repulsive.
But you see, there is a class of models where we could deal with the situation in terms of fixed points. So we could make the flow attractive to some point. We didn't need to fix a gate, and therefore achieve convergence with reasonably small Langevin times.
It looks like a fixed line, not a fixed point.
Yes, but you could put to it's really a fixed point, and then you just see it from the There is really one point where it goes to. This is not a lot.
Not the one with the arrows, the one just with the complex point, you even showed it out.
That was no longer with a fixed point. So there are two, there were...
Well, you didn't draw the arrows.
We investigated two things. One is gauge fixing, yeah. One is fixed point. They were just used without using them together. Yeah. Once we used gauge fixing to suppress fluctuations, yeah. Once we did modify the action and use stochastic reweighting techniques, so the modified action had a fixed point, mm-hmm. and we undid it by reweighting. Both these techniques worked if you, for instance, do not crank up the coupling too much.
Excuse me, did you mention why do you fix the gauge? So that there's an infinite imaginary part, or non-zero imaginary part for the trace?
No, this is not the average. The average is, of course, real.
I mean, it's...
Well, there is an...
This is not physical, no, it's just this action, and it happens to have this value for the average.
So he showed a model.
I see.
And later he showed the SU2 field theory. And there it's, of course, real.
Okay, yes, yes.
So if you go to the last page...
I only showed the real part, but yeah. You have to believe me that the imaginary part is zero.
Of the field theory, of course.
Yes.
Sure. So if you find an algorithm that would suppress fluctuations more, you could go to larger G, for instance.
Well, that amount of space you need there is a finite.
So it has a gravity dual.
You see, it goes exponentially. That's the problem. But you see, you would be fine already if you go to point A or point 9. Yeah? So.
But I'm still unclear from this discussion. What I guess it's open question. What is the source of these fluctuations and runaways?
No, you see, don't put them together, runaways.
Okay.
There are numerical issues. These have to do with runaway trajectories. These can be dealt with.
Well, the averaging over a bunch of all time is also a numerical issue. The method is average, and there's a size of it, so.
But you see, this wandering off this SU2 space is physical, it's allowed. Yeah. Whereas these runaway trajectories is something that would not be physically.
There are two sources of one is the discretization problem, which happened for non-gauge theory. Then the problem specific to gauge theory is the question is analytically continued.
The similar problem.
And you think it's
similar.
The second problem, but not the first.
Yes. So the first one can
but again, you argued, however, that if you were to treat the SL, this complexification issue exactly, it would work.
You would nevertheless find that it wanders off in the complex plane.
But with long enough averages, it would give you the right result. So it's obviously numerical, unless your previous statement was faulty. I didn't see actually. So in some sense, numerical scientific
it's a question of maybe computer time. Yes.
Or there's some more fundamental problem with
complexification.
I mean, you argue that you should give pretty good evidence for the simple integral or the SU. But is there a real theorem for if you could do things exactly?
So the best you can do for the non-abelian is to pick some operators that also have a Euclidean value that you can compare to, for instance, equal time correlators, and then you see that it coincides. There is no,
that's a numerical analytic?
Only if you go to very weak coupling, you can do perturbation theory, and then you can show if you get the correct values. That you can also do for the scalars, for instance, that has been done also. But doing perturbation theory with these methods is kind of triviality. If you do the calculation, you just have to show that the free propagator is correct, and then you do just loop integrals. Yeah. It doesn't tell you too much about the convergence of this method. Doing perturbation theory. So it doesn't tell you too much about the simulation behavior afterwards. The proof using the Langevin equation has not been given, and I think it's very difficult because you cannot say that the Fokker-Planck Hamiltonian gives you real eigenvalues.
I'm also not sure I understood the answer about the Gauss's law constraint. Are these typical configurations very far from satisfying Gauss's law?
Yes, there is no Gauss's law because they still have the time-like link.
They still have the time-like link, therefore, what? I didn't understand.
It's not a Sorry. Close question.
In the case where you fix the gauge, right, where you choose axial gauge, there you have this issue.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We can fix all but one. We have a.
Sorry, the lattice, there's a complete gauge. Mm-hmm.
Okay. No problem.
A complete gauge, isn't it?
So you fix a temporal gauge and then you fix also the residual gauge for just by putting your trajectory on the gauge plane, or?
And as a tree, you can fix over but one slice of the temporal, and then you have one spatial slice, then you can still fix some.
And you do that.
Which is a dreadful thing to use because it maximizes fluctuations in what's left over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if I try to impose that constraint during the Langevin time evolution, like perhaps choosing a noise differently or something, whether that would suppress these fluctuations which we're running away.
So we thought about, mm-hmm. I mean, different things. You see that you have a large freedom in choosing different actions by reweighting techniques, different noise terms.
Different noise,
you have very large possibility. But this is not only an advantage. Certainly there are some things, like for instance, putting in a constraint like Schwinger-Dyson type of equations. You put them on during Langevin time. So you can always put in a constraint in your equation that could lead to suppression of fluctuation.
Right. Yeah. You didn't try that.
No. I mean, but it doesn't mean that we don't think it's interesting. It's just you spend a lot of time on this. And I think having an idea a priori of what would suppress the fluctuation sufficiently, that's important.
Sure.
And so, I'm still trying to wonder whether there's some way of disentangling whether it's merely fluctuations that are too large versus a change in the fixed point structure of the drift term in your equation. If you just look at your drift forces, right, it's presumably not that hard to find fixed points and classify them, are they, you know, what degree of stability they have. Are you at all clear on whether it's changes in stability of those fixed points that correlate with when things fall apart? Or is it, as you're saying, instead some notion that the fluctuations just got out of control?
For those simple models, the Blackhead model, for instance, you could show that the presence of a fixed point gives you convergence results.
An attractive this one.
Totally attractive. Yes, totally attractive this one.
And then when you see things fall apart, is it really because that totally attractive fixed point disappeared? Turned into some pair of...
No. Now go back to this. Yes. Oh, sorry. So for that model, yes. If you go back to this...
Exactly. So this was very suggestive.
Yeah.
Might it be that this is generally true?
Having a slope means that there is always a small attractiveness to the classical fixed point. It just happens that some other fixed point might be there which sucks away.
Why kind of suggesting a way to look for this point before you do the index? Try to find the
This is what we did for this model.
That's what you did.
Yes. It's more difficult for the field theory. But for these models, you could do it, and then we did it, and it exactly appeared as he said. So also, now you could try to look for in the gauge theory whether this gauge fixed version for large enough beta gives you a fixed point, and apparently it does. It's suggested by the picture that he showed to you. And then the fixed point goes away if you make G too large.
Mm-hmm. And you can, of course, have some situation where you have a totally attractive fixed point with some basin of attraction around it. And outside that basin of attraction, you have flows which, you know, wander off to infinity. Is this now the way to think about your occasional runaway trajectories? You have some noise that bounces you from the basin of attraction that you want to be in to outside that
runway.
Basin.
Is a different story.
If the field comes here, then it just flows infinity. There would be no noise, it would just go away.
That seems to match exactly what I said. So that line is like a basin of attraction, is like the boundary of the basin of attraction of the fixed point on the left.
In this case, there's no other fixed point.
You see, people before said this theory has a sign problem. It has an oscillation, so nothing can lead to any convergence. I think this is just a different way of thinking about the problem. Now it's about flow in Langevin time to search for fixed points. And yes, if you come up with a very good fixed point, you may have solved the problem. It's a rephrasing of a difficult problem, but it's a completely different perspective you now have to this. It's no longer a sign problem. You just look for fixed points.
And welcome to optimal control theory.
Yes, and you see,
you think some of those problems are solvable, some are not solvable. There must be some criteria like this. It starts with these points, right?
And in simple theories, you can do the exercise. You can look for fixed points and see that it works. Mm-hmm. And that where the fixed point goes away, it breaks down. But in gauge theories, that's slightly more difficult. Analytically looking at it.
Gauge theory is too complicated a theory, but you can make integral with more variables, and try to find this type of situations. This is still a hypothesis that. So you have some finite dimensional integral, one integral you need, it's complex integral, right? You can imagine more complicated integrals and other integrals which will have this situation, and then you will not be able to do it. Forget the HP, you just go from, see how many problems, find the simplest problem you cannot solve, and then the disease is easier.
that would be the problem here.
So what would be needed for, I mean, you cannot do things all analytically for the non-abelian gauge theory. What you would need for is on the fly, yeah, something constrained, put it into the equation that controls the fluctuations. The constraint that you put in. The only thing that these equations have to do is to lead to the right standardized equation in the end. So there's a huge freedom.
Yeah, but there's also a reality that the physics we're interested in, like confinement, is very much a phase in which fluctuations dominate and large.
No, but these are
very observable.
The fluctuations in SU2 are fine. It's just that you have a complexified field. So you see, the fluctuations in this direction here, in a stretched direction, that's fine. You don't want the fluctuations in this direction. And as you see, the fixed point is quite successful to suppressing fluctuations in this direction. This is probably not the solution, yes, but it's a completely different way of addressing this problem. You don't think about sine problem, think about fixed form.
So there is some other problem, but this other problem is not yet clear. But there is some disease, so some complex integrals are doable, but some complex integrals are not doable. And that's the reason why they're not doable.
You mean why when you go to larger
like
beta?
And teach you like that, yes. When it is convergent, cloud,
but that would be doable if you cranked up P, right? Is that what you understood?
Okay, so then there's a function of P.
But it all boils down whether you find an attractive fixed point or not.
Yeah, but the question is, do you have some analytic control? Do you have to have some understanding of when you expect that or not? By all these examples?
Just the presence of a fixed point.
Not yet.
Not yet, okay. Did you get questions?
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you for speaking.